After shattering this, we're going to return to our review of the Torah's account of the conditions that not only existed in Eden, but what transpired after Cain, Adam, and Chawa were expelled from the Garden of Eden. What we learn here, and we're speaking of Cain, Yahweh says, and this is in Genesis 4:16, it came to be, Haya, came to exist, that he, we're speaking of Cain, built, established, Bana, a city, and called the name of the city Hanak, after his son. Hanak, whom we transliterate as Enoch, was Cain's son. Now, what we've talked about in previous programs is that this is important because we're now talking about a city during the first generation of those who were booted from the Garden of Eden. And unless they were proliferating like rabbits, and unless Hanak married his sister, which is the antithesis of what the Torah actually says, then there were Homo sapiens outside of the garden. The fact is that you don't build a city without lots of people. The species Homo habilis, Homo erectus, are a million years old, and Homo sapiens have roamed the planet for tens of thousands of years, probably very close to 100,000 years. Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden just shy of 6,000 years ago. Now, from this point, Yahweh presents Enoch's lineage. From a prophetic perspective, the most important descendant is Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of implements of bronze and iron, according to the scriptural account. Now, I share this for two reasons. First, Gog, the leader of the Islamic Magog Federation, which attacks Israel in 2027 in the Magog War, where, you know, half the world's population is going to die in the first two phases of that war. So it's a rather serious conflict. Gog, who is the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, is therefore from Meshach and Tubal, and we're here talking about Tubal-Cain. And when we look at where the Garden of Eden was, and which is Lake Van in eastern Turkey, we find that that Tubal would have been in eastern Turkey, and therefore this Islamic leader that is going to rally Team Islam for a unified attack on Israel is going to be from eastern Turkey. Now, there's something else that was found in eastern Turkey. Have you ever read any of the reports written by a fellow named Ron Wyatt, Larry?
Yeah, I have.
Ron, like so many of us, got certain things right, got certain things wrong. But Ron, the things that Ron got right is that he found Mount Horeb, and it's obvious he found it. He found exactly on Nuweiba Beach where the children of Israel were stranded until with the Egyptians coming through the army the mountain passes, and where then Yahweh parted the Gulf of Aqaba arm of the Red Sea and went across on what is a land bridge there. And he found all of the evidence, chariot wheels and the like, there in the water.
I've seen that.
Yeah, and really fascinating. And then he found the pillar where the Solomon erected to where the children of Israel, based on the miracle that Yahweh had provided, crossed the Red Sea there, and then went into to the environs of Mount Horeb. You can see where the people have marched there. You can see the seared top of the mountain even today in satellite imagery. You can see where the Moses hit as opposed to spoke to the rock, and it gushed forth with water for the people. You can even see the foundation that was built for the golden calf. All there for us to see. And the first to find this was none other than Ron Wyatt. Now, why he is germane to this particular discussion is that Ron Wyatt found also the ark that was constructed by Noah. And you can Google the area that use Google satellite imagery of the area that Ron claims to have found it, and you can actually see the boat laying right there, just through satellite imagery. The Turkish government in eastern Turkey, just east of Lake Van, has made a national park of it, and has a viewing station of the Ark. I've seen parts of the Ark that were brought back by Ron Wyatt. Ron's has passed, but his widow maintains a museum in Tennessee. Been there. Actually seen remnants of the Ark. And it's in the mountains of Ararat. 6,300 feet MSL is where the Ark is found now. It was found in 1991. If you read his material, you'll find that he tested the rivets which held the mighty Ark together. They were 8.3% aluminum, 10.4% iron, 1.3% magnesium, 2.7% sodium, 1.9% titanium. That's a pretty fancy mix for rivets for Noah, but he had a really good set of plans and a instructor in this regard, and he followed Yahweh's instructions. Even the ballast of the ship was consistent with high-tech metal production. For more on this, if you're interested, for those who may be interested, it's the Wyatt Archaeological Museum. It is in Tennessee, and their discovery volume on Noah's Ark and the Exodus, Sodom and Gomorrah, all really interesting reviews. And so this is germane to our study here just because Yahweh tells us about the Ark. We're going to spend a month on just the story of the flood and the Ark, but also the reality is that when God tells a story, it is based in history, it is grounded in reality. We know that Cain, and therefore this town named after Enoch, was in eastern Turkey. And eastern Turkey is meaningful here because that's where you'll find the headwaters of both the Tigris and Euphrates River, which became the basis of civilization. Almost all early human civilizations are the earliest of them. Can be dated to this time, about 4000 BCE, and they're found along the Tigris and Euphrates River or along the Black Sea there in the area of eastern Turkey, down through what is today modern Iran and Iraq. All of Cain's descendants would be eliminated in the flood, which is still 1,000 years in their future. The names of these people, however, are indicative of their fate. The first was Irad from Y-R-A-D. Its root, A-N-Y-R, speaks of a young male ass, and thus is prophetic of the descendants of Ishmael, the patriarch of today's Muslims. Mahu Ya'el is a compound name, which means one who dances circles around God. He was indicative of the religious schemes born out of Babylon. Mahya'el means those who accept money or compensation in exchange for godly activities. It's predictive.
Well, we've got religious names going on here all over the place.
You betcha, of Catholicism and their indulgences. It's the reason why Yahweh wiped out the humans with a Nesama in the flood.
Interestingly enough, I've only seen one half mosque, half church, and I saw that in Istanbul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Women's names were named Ada and Zilla. Ada means to prowl about in search of prey and to remove a victim from its rightful place. It also means to adorn oneself in splendor, wearing ornaments of jewels and gold, glorifying oneself and claiming a high status. As such, God is continuing to warn us about the negative influence of politicized religious schemes. Now, her son was named Jabal from Yabel, meaning someone who guides or directs a movement, and desert village surrounding a poorly performing spring in a ravine. This is descriptive, of course, of Muhammad in Mecca. And it should be noted that Yabal also means wart, a seeping sore which just discharges bodily fluids. According to Muhammad, the sign that he was a prophet, the proof that he was a prophet, was such a seeping sore, a wart. And it is distinguished in the Islamic hadith as a reddish seeping wart that proved Muhammad.
That would pretty much prove you're a prophet because you've got a reddish seeping sore. I mean, that proves it to me.
Yeah, well, that's according to Muhammad, was served as proof since he couldn't perform any miracles or never was empowered to offer any prophecies. The best he had was the wart. Zilla is the self-imposed will of an overbearing person who overpowers the populace through force of arms. Yeah, it's really a wonderful group of names here. Her name also means the messenger of the shadow. She was the mother of Tabul Cain, and by way of her name, it explains how Islam was conceived and grew. Muhammad was the overbearing person who overpowered the population through force of arms. He was the shadow's messenger. It is how he established and funded his satanic religion, as well as being descriptive of his dogma and how he and Muslims would behave. So it's an interesting group of names. They're worth our consideration because it explains why God had to eliminate them. Then, while Cain, which means a spearhead and sword, and thus is indicative of how Islam was spread, and Tubal, which is Hubal in Hebrew, describes the result of religion, which is a return to sorrow and anguish. Scripture says that this bad boy forged and fashioned many things, engraving tools used to cut and inscribe a plot and devise an evil scheme, charas, with metal implements, nahoset, copper and bronze, fetters of lust and harlotry, and iron, barzel. This is from Genesis 4:22. So even the Quran calls Islam Allah's plot and scheme. Yes, in the Quran itself, Islam is called Allah's plot, Allah's scheme. It was the inscribed scheme forged of sharpened implements of iron, wielded by jihadists in league with Satan. So throughout this region, we find so many indications of the religion that would be bred in these parts. So as we consider the names of the people that were conceived in the immediate aftermath of mankind being booted from the Garden of Eden, it becomes clear that this would not be the line from which Noah would be born, because Noah, which means the trustworthy guide in Hebrew, he was going to be a different line, as would the Messiah. And so Yahweh tells us, and Adam became acquainted with Yada. He knew intimately his wife, his Isha. Isha, of course, is that incredibly important term that witness throughout four of Yahweh's Moed Mikre, where we're asked to come into the presence of the Isha, which is both the feminine word for fire in Hebrew, or light, and also the Hebrew word for wife, woman, mother. And so God is asking us during these four of these seven invitations to answer his invitation and to come into the presence of the feminine or maternal manifestation of his light. And here he's using Yada Isha. So Adam became acquainted with Yada, his wife Isha, again. And she gave birth to Yalad, a son, Ben, and called Kara, his name Shem, Seth. Sheth is six. It's based upon it means both six, base and foundation. Because, for the reason key, the Almighty caused, established, and ordained for me another seed in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. All right. So here in his testimony, we see once again the juxtaposition of Kara and Isha. Isha meaning the feminine manifestation of God's light, and Kara is the means that God has provided for us to reconcile our relationship with him. And it is from this line, from Seth's line, that we're going to find the children of Yisrael, and therefore Yahusha. And Kara is the basis for the seven mikre, based upon the verb Kara, which means it's Yahweh's invitations to call us out so that we can meet with him. In the name Seth, God revealed that the foundation of his plan for man was six. So it says here that that he called his name Seth because the Almighty caused, established, and ordained for me another seed in place of Abel. And so the establishment would be based upon Seth, and Seth means six, the foundation. And six is the number of man, the number of the element that is unique to animal life is carbon, which is carbon, is also six. God is reemphasizing that with Seth. Seth means six. There would be six eras of mankind, each 1,000 years long, followed by a millennial Shabbat. That is what Yah established and ordained. If you pause to think about it, it's all fairly obvious. After all, by naming the third kid Six, the son upon which the foundation was set for our eternal redemption, God was either trying to tell us something profound or revealing that he can't count. So this was the third child of Adam and Chawa, and they named him Six. So what we learn by Seth is that Six is an incredibly important aspect of understanding God's testimony. Larry, I think it was in a different program on Yada Yada Radio, you asked me the how is it that so many people get God's timing wrong and are wrong in terms of predicting when he's going to return? And my answer is always the same, is that they don't pay attention to what God had to say. Now, God's really clear that his plan is 6 plus 1. It's modeled right after the creation account. It's modeled after the Shabbat. The creation account is 6 plus 1. The Shabbat is 6 plus 1. His mikre, these invitations to meet with him, to be called out of the world, and to be welcomed into his presence, based upon 6 plus 1. Six steps we take to God, so that on Sukkah, shelters, we can camp out with him. This son of Adam and Chawa was named Six. You just got to look at the words, observe the words that Yahweh shared with us, and go with them to where they lead. It's really as simple as that. So God said to Seth, also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And we'll consider what Enosh means when we return to Shattering Myths with Larry joining us after the commercial break. As we continue to examine Yah's testimony, we are confronted with the next name in the list to Seth, to Six. Also a son was born. He called his name Enosh. Enosh means mortal humankind. Enosh is used as a word throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Now God has a bunch of names, many names actually, for humans. He'll use Adam, which is a person, particularly a man, born with a nesama, a descendant of the first human with a nesama, Adam. He'll use Ish, which means individual. Even when he's speaking of himself, he will distinguish himself. You know, like in English, we have the word person, and then we have persona. With persona perhaps indicating personality. But in Hebrew, an individual is an ish, where a man is Adam, but he will also use Enosh for mortal humankind. And it's interesting that he does so many different places, because what it says, not only did Yahweh say that Adam and Chawa would die as a result of disregarding his testimony, but this son of six is named mortal humankind. Our souls are mortal. It's one of the great myths of religion, Larry, isn't it, that almost all religions teach that the soul is immortal, and that the soul is destined to either eternal torment in hell or an eternal reward in heaven, and your compliance and your donations to their religion or jihad acts in the case of Islam would determine whether or not your soul goes to eternal torment or eternal anguish. And yet,
that's one of the myths that really throws me, because then you've got this deity, this religious deity, you wouldn't want to be around for 5 minutes, much, much less an eternity, because he's really saying, love me and follow me and worship me or I'll burn you in hell forever. So, right. So if I said to you, Yada, you know, I want to be your good friend. I want you to give me some money. If you don't, I'll burn your house down. I wouldn't be a very likable guy. And that's, you know, it's a sad, I wouldn't want to be around the religious deity that thinks like that for a moment. I'd rather be dead. I'd rather just be.
Right. And yet, the Christian God, it's either heaven or hell.
Yeah, right.
And
they
get compliance.
Yahweh's words say it all. But,
They get compliance on that basis. And part of that is that they preach that the soul is immortal. Human souls are not immortal.
Yahweh is from Nefesh. That means like breath, you know.
Right.
Now the soul, everything has a soul. A fish has Nefesh. It's just consciousness. That's it.
Right. Yeah, until it dies, and then it goes away. And that's what Yahweh says is, I'm going to be really fair about all this. He says, if you choose to reject my guidance, or ignore my guidance, or any of those kind of choices, ignore it reject it, then at the end of your earthly existence, you're simply going to die. I gave you life, temporal life. I gave you free will. I gave you a nesama, a conscience, so that you could consider my testimony. I gave you my Torah to reveal who I am and what I'm offering. I established the covenant for you so that you could receive all of its blessings. I've given you all of this, and now it's up to you. If you choose to participate in the covenant, great. Here's the benefits, and you'll become immortal.
And I'd just like to throw this out here for people that find that shocking. You know, if I was sitting down and having dinner and heard, you know, in the background on a radio or television that two people got killed on the highway today, blah, 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 and local news, I'd continue eating. I might say, you know, it's a rough place to drive out there, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if somebody called and they said, you know, your daughter just got killed in the...
Right.
Then that would become a different issue to me. And Yahweh does not call death punishment. People just die.
No.
Everything dies. No. You know, a lion on the Serengeti plain dies. He's not being punished. Everything is as you're saying, temporal. But in order for a soul to become immortal, Yahweh has to do something.
Right.
And he's going to do that for the people that what? That he knows.
Exactly. We read about the 15,500 people that were killed in terrorist acts this past year, according to START. The likelihood is, since they were victims of Islamic terrorism, that few, if any of them, knew Yahweh, responded to the terms and conditions of the covenant, so they're just simply gone. And it isn't a punishment. And so God can be eminently fair. He can say, I am offering you eternal life, empowerment, adoption into my family, perfection, and enrichment if you choose to answer my invitations, come into my home, and accept all that I am offering you. That's one option. But if you choose to ignore it, to reject it, to believe in a false deity, like a Jesus Christ, like an Allah, if you choose to, or like man in the case of socialist secular humanism, if you choose to rely and trust on a false deity and ignore what I have to say, then upon your demise, you're simply going to cease to exist. It's like the 15,500 people we read in Islam.
I typically don't like to interject the witness writings, but there were witness writings, and then I don't call them scripture, but still, you know, they tell us something. And there was a friend of Yahusha's, somebody he knew well, who died, and his family went to him. And what did Yahusha do? Because he knew him. He was even in tears, remember?
He
went, I forget the guy's name, but what was it, Lazarus?
Correct.
Yeah, and he, he brought him back to life. Why? Right. Because he knew him. There were all kinds of people dying in the land.
Did Lazarus end up dying?
Well, sure he did.
Yeah, sure he did. Yeah, absolutely.
But his soul didn't. I'm sure of that. I'm sure he because, you know, Yahusha knew him. Yahweh knew him. You know, he wasn't going anywhere. I mean, he was going to live forever. And that's the truth. And that's what happened to him in the end, no doubt.
Exactly. And that bit of a resurrection, if you will, was from a physical place to a physical place. There are examples in Yashaya, where Yashaya, who we know as Isaiah, is also speaking. He's speaking using very colorful, poetic language of the Valley of Dry Bones, and he's also speaking of how he wants and envisions someday that his bones will stand and walk again in the land. And it's very poetic, symbolic discussion, but it's still from a physical place to a physical place. There is no example of bodily resurrection from a physical place to a spiritual place. There's no bodies in heaven. And so that was a temporary act.
Therefore, that goes back to our original point here, is that if I'm a spiritual being, which would be pure energy, how does fire hurt me now? If you're going to burn me in hell.
That's why hell is a lightless place apart from God. And there's no torture in hell. In fact, Islam depicts Allah in hell torturing people. Yah's depiction of the place is called Sheol, and his depiction of the place is very similar to a black hole. It's just a lightless place where those who chose to deceive, because there has to still be a consequence of the most egregious behavior. The most egregious behavior, egregious behavior according to Yahweh is to lead people away from him, to misrepresent his testimony. Which means if you're a religious preacher, if you're a religious imam, if you're a religious rabbi, or if you're engaged in politics and trying to get people dependent on your government health care program and your government social security program, or telling people that their freedom is a result of their government's military, then you're going to have been deemed as having decided not just to have been the victim of politics or religion, but to be a victimizer. And those people will suffer a consequence.
At that point, you're seen as a spiritual being because you're affecting other spirits and you've entered into an agreement with a spirit. Therefore, you will get the abyss. So, I mean, he does punish people. Right. He says so right there in his statements, the third statement there that they call the third commandment. He says he will he'll punish people that do that. Absolutely.
He'll hold them accountable. It's separate. It is eternal separation from Yahweh. So here Seth had a son. To him was born, and he called his name Enosh, which means mortal humankind. And Enosh represents uncorrupted and Nesama-equipped sons and daughters of Adam and Chawa. He was central to the line that brought about the likeness of Noah, of Abraham, of Moshe, of Dod, and Yahusha. And we read further that at that time, the defiled and profane called out in the name of Yahweh. So at that time, the defiled and profane, the defiled and profane is interesting word choice here. It is from Halal. The corruptible and degraded, the once proud but now humbled and wounded, the polluted and the corrupted called out in the name of Yahweh. You see, halal, which is the in Arabic, is the term used to describe food which is nourishing, or behavior which is appropriate, any behavior which is considered Sharia compliant, like the bonds being offered by Prime Minister Cameron and the United Kingdom, they are halal. Well, in Hebrew, halal is contemptible, degraded, polluted, corrupted. Halal, as noted earlier, is Satan's first name. It's Halal ben Shakar. The profound.
Yeah, you find that twice in the Qumran scrolls in Yasha Yahu. That's his name.
Yeah.
Halal ben Shakar. So you're going to go out and eat halal food?
Brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. Well, that's it. And I consider Islam to be purely satanic. And the one of the evidences of that is that halal is considered that which is most nourishing, that which is most beneficial, that which is most religiously pure in Islam, and yet it is also Satan's first name. His actual name, because the rest of his name, the Ben Shakar, means that he's the son of the rising sun. So halal, profaned and defiled, contemptible, degraded, and corrupt. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. As we consider this last statement, it's obvious that at this point, all men and women were estranged from Yahweh. They were all defiled and degraded by Satan's scheme. They had all chosen to reject his testimony, his instructions. They were therefore all mortal. And yet these souls would have known Yahweh by reputation and by name, particularly through the relationship that Yahweh had with Adam and Chawa in the garden, and subsequently also with Cain and Abel. So he would have been known. Some sought redemption and reconciliation, and Kara summoned him for help. Others, Kara cried out against God, having chosen a different path. So the point of this passage is to tell us that mankind was in a fallen state, expelled from the sheltered and joyous garden of God's protection. They were now mortal and defiled, and thus in need of redemption. And for that, we must call out to Yahweh by name, and we approach him through the Kara, which is the Mikra, the seven invitations to meet with him. Now, from God's perspective, we are still in the sixth day of creation. The seventh day will commence on Sukkah in 2033, which is year 6000 Yah. And that is why we read this testimony in the beginning of the fifth chapter, verses 1 and 2 of Bereshith. This is the written account of the genealogy of man in the day God created Adam, making him in the likeness of the Almighty. Male and female, he created them. And he kneeled down to bless them. He got on his knees to greet, praise, and lift them up. Then he called them, invited them by name, Adam, in the day that they were created.
Can I ask you something here, Yada?
Sure, go ahead.
Does Yahweh need your help?
Nope. Enjoys it,
well, then,
but doesn't need it.
Somebody must have it backwards, because here Yahweh's kneeling down to help us.
Yeah.
But in so many religious settings, I see people kneeling down and asking to help him or something.
Yeah, exactly the opposite. It's is interesting that God chooses to work through men and women, enjoys the company of men and women. And likes it, encourages us for us to work with him. That's why I said, does he need you or me? No, of course not. But does he enjoy you and I? Absolutely. Can he and will he and does he enjoy working through us? Absolutely. That is his preference. That's his style. The reason he lifts us up.
To help you?
He kneels down to lift us up. So you are correct that the great divide between relationship and religion is this word, Barak. What it says is that God got on his knees to lift us up, which means we're contradicting and we are negating everything that he has done for us when we get back down on our knees. You know, God got on his knees to lift us up. The last thing he wants us to do is get on his, on our knees to lift him up. I mean, what a stupid thing to do. And so this idea that you get on your knees and praise God is the antithesis of God's vision for our relationship. That's the religious perspective. On your knees, lifting up God.
And he,
the relationship view is the father relationship, where the father gets on his knees to lift up his son or daughter.
Yeah, and then he says he created him in the image of the Almighty, male and female. He created them. Now that's extant material, isn't it? That's Qumran scrolls.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Scrolls.
Ultimately, yeah.
Male and female. He created them in his image. So
right.
He did that with Nisama, with both of them.
Right. So
wow.
he has defined the Isha that he has called us, invited us to come into the presence of during these seven Moed Mikre. By doing so, what God has said is that he has a masculine and feminine aspect to his nature, that he has a paternal and maternal aspect to his nature, that an aspect of Yahweh is our spiritual mother, while an aspect of Yahweh is our heavenly father.
Yeah,
he serves in both of those
something
roles.
Something from Job, which
sure.
Kind of emphasizes that.
Sure.
That means Yah's lamb. It's we call it, I guess, Job, which has no
yes.
meaning, 32:8. But here it is. Indeed, the spirit, she, in mortal man, and the Nesama of the Almighty provides understanding and reaches them. Wow.
Yeah, we'll have to expand on that on tomorrow's program. Thank you, Larry, for joining us, and for all of you who are listening to Yah's testimony. May Yah bless you all.